So you can find rainforest destruction in any room of your house is the shortest connection. So there's also the connection between rainforest and climate change. And that's one of the things that most people are surprised to learn is that tropical rainforests in particular are a massive storehouse of carbon. And right now they're being cut down for things like paper that you can still find in books, for things like palm oil, which is an additive that's found in nearly half of the processed foods at a grocery store. And so you're likely to find all of these products in your house, which means not only are you contributing to climate change when these forests are cut and the emissions are released, but you're contributing to species extinction, to human rights violations that happen as people are forced off of their land. And so the flip side of that is you can vote with your pocketbook and have a tremendous impact, even here in Colorado, on rainforests all across the globe.
Which country has the biggest geographic area of rainforests?
The largest rainforest in the world is in the Amazon. And so that's in Latin America. It extends multiple countries. That's actually where Rainforest Action Network started. We started looking at cattle expansion and beef that was ending up in Burger King. And that was what kind of started our whole model, as we said, so listen, we're here in the United States. We know that folks consuming Burger King are having this tremendous impact on the Amazon rainforest. And is it possible from here to leverage our consumer voice and our consumer vote to shift the way that companies are behaving? And the result was there was a series of contract cancellations, and it sent a signal that cattle companies could not just indiscriminately clear the Amazon rainforest just to make room for more cattle.
So are these corporations who are involved in the destruction of the rainforest, whether it's cattle companies, whether it's palm oil distributors or generators, are they doing all of this with the blessing of the governments in those countries?
It varies. So in Brazil, we've seen that the government has taken a more active role in cutting down on illegal deforestation or immoral deforestation that's just kind of incoherently spreading into the frontier. In places like Indonesia, which is our main priority region right now, it's another one of the three large tropical forest areas in the world. It really varies. And what we see is that government policy does incentivize these companies, but companies are, you know, there's a lot of corruption and they're taking advantage of as many loopholes as possible. So in one example, you can see that communities that are fighting to get their customary native land rights recognized could spend years, you know, one community spent 18 years fighting a court battle. And at the same time, a pulp and paper or palm oil company can come in and get permits in a matter of weeks because they pay bribes to the local government. So what we see as a solution is really working at that intersection. So let's pull these companies back. Let's show them that they're not going to find a market for their products unless they shift their behaviors, unless they start to address corruption and refuse to pay bribes, unless they pay for the true cost of these products, including true labor costs, where, you know, in the case of palm oil, child and forced labor are still used. And that's one of the reasons why this is the cheapest vegetable oil in the world. And so let's shift the behavior of these companies, and that gives the government some space to enforce policies that would both recognize land rights and think about, you know, land development in a more holistic way.
You said that there are some policies in place that not just enable, but also incentivize the destruction of some of the rainforests. What kind of policies?
That's right. So, you know, what we really focus on is the economic driver. And if you think about Indonesia has moved from a democracy out of a dictatorship, and yet some of the largest companies there had ties and kind of got their start during the dictatorship. So they, as democracy was blossoming, they really tried to ensure that the new democracy would still allow themselves easy access to land. And so you'll have various ministries that overlap and there's not one map. So there's confusion about who owns this land or, you know, which company owns what piece of land. And what that incentivizes is companies will expand into the rainforest, clear it as quickly as possible, drain these peat swamps, which are these carbon storehouses, kick communities off their land so that they can prove that they have claim to it. So what we've said is, you know, we've had a lot of success in the pulp and paper sector, saying to the largest pulp and paper producer in the country, which is a company called Asia Pulp and Paper, to say, listen, you need to adopt a policy that says you will not expand into rainforests anymore. You will not continue to displace communities. And that's, they've had the policy for 2 years. We've been watchdogging them to make sure that they're actually resolving land conflicts with communities. And that's where they still need to make a lot of progress. But they have made progress in stopping some of the active clearing. So then once you get the largest pulp and paper company to make a shift, and we got to them by going through Disney, because Disney is the largest children's book and magazine publisher in the world, and we found that some of their kids' books contain rainforest destruction. So after 18 months of negotiations, Disney adopted this policy that sent this ripple effect that APP felt, Asia Pulp and Paper. So we start to see, okay, this, now that the largest company has shifted its practices, then it's incentivized to go to the government and say, we want a level playing field. So we need to shift and we need to think about land use more comprehensively.
Is there any kind of designation for rainforest-friendly products that people, that consumers can look for, much the same way that we're seeing, say, with coffee, fair trade, organic, shade grown, different things like that? Is there some kind of label or any movement to get any kind of labeling happening so people, consumers, feel more confident in what they're buying?
Yeah, we have seen a whole variety of labels. You know, there's a label for palm oil, and it's called the RSPO label, or Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil. The problem is they're very influenced by industry, and so there's still an incentive for them to water down their standards. So that's why we aren't kind of putting all of our eggs in the labeling basket. We're really going to the largest, some of the largest companies. One example would be Pepsi. Right now, PepsiCo uses about 1% of the global supply of palm oil. We've pressured them with the support of many activists to say, listen, you need to change this and you need to have complete traceability so that your customers know anywhere in the world, if they buy a PepsiCo product, it's not coming from rainforest destruction or human rights abuses. And so they have essentially taken, they've gone halfway. They've said, okay, we know that there are some issues around deforestation. And I think they were testing to see if activists would be satisfied by that, or if, you know, we would all kind of stay firm and say, no, you really need to move on human rights as well. And so that's where we are with Pepsi. We have targeted 20 snack food companies that are similar in size to Pepsi. And you can actually take a look at rand.org. In terms of, you know, in the next 2 weeks, we'll be updating our scorecard of which have moved and which continue to be laggards. And then as we find laggards, that's where we use public pressure to show them that they need to shift.
The Girl Scouts got a lot of bad publicity.
They did. They did. So about 5 years ago, there were two Girl Scouts who were activists, Maddie and Rhiannon, who came to Ran and said, listen, we were doing a project around orangutans and what was driving extinction. We found out that palm oil is the leading driver putting orangutans at risk of extinction. And then we realized that that was in the Girl Scout cookies that we were selling. So for a while, we kind of worked together to help raise the public profile of that so that they could help to kind of enter conversations with the Girl Scouts organization to shift the practices of, you know, how they were supplying palm oil for their cookies.
And have they?
They have made, you know, I would say that they've made half steps. Where really what happened was the sector shifted around them. So they did become more willing to have conversations with Maddie and Rhiannon, and I think that was a really positive step, particularly since they're motivated to empower girls. They didn't move as quickly as we would have liked, but we also said we would take the lead of Maddie and Rhiannon. And then what ended up happening is the bakers that they were using started to adopt policies because they saw the writing on the wall.
Can you give us some concrete numbers, some statistics about how much rainforest is being destroyed and maybe how that translates into carbon reduction or various different things like that?
Yeah. So the easiest way to explain the carbon equation is to really think about, you have these very lush, dense tropical rainforests and leaf litter falls over generations and generations, and that builds up. And that creates what's called peat, which, you know, if you're a gardener, you think of peat. Peat is actually the coal of the future. And when they, you know, when companies come in to clear these rainforests, they also need to drain the water table and expose the peat. That is what essentially sends off a carbon bomb into the atmosphere. So global tropical deforestation accounts for roughly 20% of global emissions, which means if we stopped deforestation, we would see an immediate reduction of 20% of our global emissions. And as we talk about getting closer to these climate tipping points, that's a tremendous impact that we can have by making different decisions and by having transparency in supply chains and by doing things like buying local. And, you know, if you're using food in your garden instead of using processed foods at the grocery store, then you know the impact that you're having in terms of reducing emissions, not only in transportation, but in how those products are produced.
Given the impact that deforestation is having on climate change, do you and folks like yourselves who are fighting against deforestation, do you have a seat at the table in the major climate talks that are happening?
Yeah, it varies. I think we can get a seat at the table. It's not always where we need to be. So, you know, I was at the UN climate meeting that happened in New York in September. I actually hadn't asked for credentials for the meeting. We hadn't applied because Rainforest Action Network does do direct actions, and I have a legal history that demonstrates that. I was surprised to get the unrequested invite and to get all the way into the floor of the UN. And the reason that we were there was and had been invited was to listen to Cargill, which is one of the largest kind of middlemen in the supply chain of global food trade, make their zero deforestation commitment. And they agreed. We had been targeting them for 7 years. They initially said that what we were asking for was crazy because we said, you need to address palm oil production in Indonesia. They both have plantations there and they're buying it and trading it. And you need to use this model if you can figure this out in Indonesia because of the challenge around land claims and around emissions and around human rights violations. If you can figure it out here, then it's going to be a good model for you to shift and to apply across any region where you're having an impact on forests and communities. And so at that meeting in the UN, they did announce their zero deforestation commitment that was global, that is global. And so now we're still working with them and many other allies who were part of that movement on implementation. But I would say that that change didn't happen because we were at the table or in the meeting. It happened because thousands of people all around the world told Cargill that what they were doing was unacceptable. And so people's movements, and this is one of the things that we'll talk about tomorrow night, on Wednesday night, people's movements are where we are seeing this change created.
Well, you talked about being involved in direct action. What are some of the ways that RAN and you yourself have been involved in that?
Yeah. So one of the things that we'll also be talking about at Rembrandt Yard, joined by Jane Klebb from Bold, Nebraska, is the Keystone XL pipeline fight. And the contribution that Rainforest Action made to that, because we also, in addition to our tropical forest program, climate is one of the greatest drivers of deforestation at this point as well. When we think about global ecosystems, we need to be thinking about the climate. So for more than the last decade, we've had a climate and energy program. And one of the things we do is we look at who's financing climate change. We look at some of the banks. And we look at where are these touchdown points where communities and grassroots organizers who are given additional tools could make an exponential impact. So with the Keystone Pipeline, with the other 98% and a group called Credo, we launched and said, okay, all across the country, we are interested in finding out if you would be willing to risk arrest in order to stop this pipeline, to show that civil disobedience is an escalation of how serious climate change is in terms of risk to our future and the future of, you know, generations to come. And the result was over 100,000 people all across the country said, yes, we're ready. And so then we kind of went out, we call it the snowflake organizing model. So we went out, we gave folks skills in terms of how to safely and peacefully, but in a way that disrupted operations, could, decide to do their own actions. From there, we, you know, then folks went out and trained themselves and kind of disseminated the information. So that's the organizing model that we used. And our hope was that the risk of people all across the country escalating to this level would be enough for President Obama to reject the pipeline, in addition to all the many legal challenges and the widespread, you know, disapproval for his potential to support the pipeline. And so we haven't had to deploy it yet. And now, comparing it to 3 years ago when we started the pledge and everybody was saying that Keystone Pipeline was going to get rubber stamped, I think we're in a very good place, and we're hoping that any day now Obama will reject the Keystone Pipeline, which should be the kind of first of his many rejections of some of these horrible infrastructure projects.
What other direct action have you been involved in? Because when we think of rainforest or deforestation, you know, I think of Oregon, maybe Northern California, people literally living in trees mm-hmm. to stop the loggers coming in. I mean, there are various different grades, I suppose, of direct action
Absolutely.
For people who might not feel committed enough to go live in a tree for a year or two. There are other ways that people can get involved. What other direct action approaches have you taken?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the start of a product to the end of a product, there are so many points of intervention along that whole scale. And one of the things with the Keystone Pipeline, you know, if for the folks that aren't excited about living in a tree and protecting a forest for a year or a longer period, you can A, just support people doing that because it's actually challenging to do that work. But you can also, you know, think about banks. Banks have a tremendous role in financing climate chaos. And one of the other issues that we've really been working on for a long time is banks who are propping up the coal industry. And so for, you know, almost a decade, we've been running a variety of different bank campaigns. For the past couple years, we've been pressuring Bank of America with activists all across the country who would do everything from, you know, creative activities inside of a bank branch lobby to, you know, direct action being closing their accounts and saying, I do not want to finance this type of climate disruption, in addition to, you know, they don't want to finance the destabilization of our livelihoods that we saw with the last market turn. So it's really anything. You know, you can show up outside of a legislator's office and decide not to leave until you've been heard. And I think that's how we start to see our voices add up to the call that we're really hearing now, that, you know, we need to keep fossil fuels in the ground. Experts have said 80% of fossil fuel reserves need to stay in the ground. And the market is not following that because they're on these very short-term scales. You know, they're thinking about the next quarter or maybe the next year. And all of us have the opportunity to think about, you know, I think about the generations that will come after me. And that's my horizon. And that means I need to be doing work now to keep those fossil fuels in the ground. And, you know, direct actions were one of the key things that we dropped. For instance, the Bank of America has a stadium, and we dropped a big banner. And so we renamed it instead of Bank of America Stadium. We renamed it Bank of Coal Stadium. And that was just one of the many, many things. Folks would, you know, occupy bank branches. They would do creative, they would kind of put these stickers over ATM machines talking about what you're actually financing when you do business with the bank branches. And this year we were excited to announce that Bank of America has actually just confirmed its commitment to phase out its financing of coal. And that's compared to a few years ago when they were the number one financier of coal and they were determined to stay in that position. So that's the type of shift that we can see. That means that companies like Alpha and Arch and, you know, these coal companies that have been trying to stay alive while contributing massive emissions and health impacts in communities like Appalachia will not be able to get financing when they need to renew their debts in the next couple of years.
Well, people will be able to hear more about the power of people-powered movements, particularly when it comes to climate change. Lindsay Allen will be speaking on Wednesday evening, starts at 6 o'clock at the Rembrandt Yard in Boulder. She's the Executive Director of Rainforest Action Network. Jane Klebe with Bold Nebraska will be speaking about her experience in Nebraska, particularly around organizing to stop the Keystone XL pipeline. And it's all happening Wednesday, May 20th at the Rembrandt Yard in Boulder. There's more information at ran.org/Boulder and at our website, kgnu.org. Lindsay Allen, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.